I was sharing my life story earlier, but I didn't get to the point where we were called into the truth. But it did happen. And when it happened, we were determined that we wanted to get ourselves in a place where we could keep all of the holidays, every single one of them. So we came in, we did what we had to do, and we were first introduced to the Passover on the Days of Unleavened Bread. Initially, there are some things about the bread that I did not understand, I must confess. But I know that it was different. I could tell that it was different from every other bread. And when I walk into the supermarkets, not so much back home, but off the island, I see so many different types of bread. But this one was different. We could tell. It looked different, and it tasted different. Even though the box, the container, is kind of pretty, but when you open it, you realize it's a different kind of bread. So as I stick around in the church, I got to understand why this bread was different and to appreciate the difference, because knowing it's different is one thing, appreciating the difference is another thing. If I'm speaking too fast, you can slow me down here. Just wave and just slow down. Okay. So as I continued to observe the feast and examine this bread, sermon, it was pretty interesting as well. I get to realize why this bread was different. So to prove my point, let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 16 first. Deuteronomy 16, and I suspect you might share my experience that there is something different about this bread. Deuteronomy 16, we're reading from verse 1 to verse 3. Observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover to the Lord your God, for in the month of Abib the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. Therefore you shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. You shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it, that is, the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. Did I hear the bread of affliction? I never knew it was the bread of affliction. And why affliction? Because nobody wants affliction. Why would we go eat the bread of affliction? So I discovered that, yes, this thing that I was excited about, this thing called matzo, was known by another name, the bread of affliction. I said, wow, why am I going to eat this bread? But yes, we were so excited to get to know matzo and to celebrate these interesting days, knowing as well that, you know, coming out of a Sunday movement, that this was true. It was in Scripture, the days of unleavened bread and the Passover. So I discovered soon after that this bread of affliction, or this biscuit, was about not just a bread or a biscuit, it was a way of life. Yeah, a way of life. And that way of life, I discovered as well, was pretty problematic for many people. I look at a couple of examples as well. That this affliction bread could be a problem for some. Let's go to John chapter 6. John chapter 6. And verse 53. John 6, 53. Then Jesus said to them, most surely Most assuredly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers ate the manna and are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever. So, it's an interesting bread we're talking about. These things he said in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum. Therefore, many of his disciples, when they heard this, they said, "This is a hard saying. Who can understand it?" This bread was not as nice as it ought to be. It was hard. It was hard bread. Back home, hard bread was, you know, when the bread comes fresh off from the bakery and you put it down for a week, and then it becomes real hard. But it wasn't just that. Literal bread we're talking about now here. It's the way of life that Christ is calling persons to. And they said, "This is a hard saying." In other words, it's very hard bread. Bread of affliction. Pretty hard. Let's go to Matthew chapter 7 as well. Matthew 7. And we're going to read verse 13, 14. Again, Jesus is speaking. He says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it." And that is also, you know, pretty interesting words from Christ. "The easy way or the easy road many will take. The hard road or the hard bread or the bread of affliction many will reject." And this seems quite natural. Seems pretty natural. So we know that the road on which we have been placed to travel is a hard road. That the bread we are called to eat, the body of Christ, is the bread of affliction. Not very welcoming, is it? We'd rather hear the very opposite. Give us easy bread. Put us on an easy road, man. But that's not the case. This is a hard saying. So let's go to verse 66. Of John 6. John 6, 6, verse 6, 6 sounds like the mark of the beast. John 6, which maybe is what happened here. Verse 66. This is a hard saying. Verse 6, 6, "From that time many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more." No, this bread is too hard. The affliction is too much. We can't stay with your Christ. So they said goodbye. They no longer walked with him. Just about 2 weeks ago, I received a video someone sent me, and I discovered one of these guys who no longer walk with Christ. He did a video, and I tried to summarize what he said in the video. The title of his thing was "Growing Up in a Doomsday Cult and End of Days Christian Cult Called the Worldwide Church of God." Yeah. This young man, that was the title of his video. Growing up in a doomsday cult, an end of days Christian cult called Worldwide Church of God. I didn't grow up in it, but I knew of it, and I had what I learned from it was wonderful. Well, here are the things that caused some problems for him and apparently his family. Here's what he said. He said, the leader of the church called himself the one true Messiah of God. And, you know, we could go through and look if all of the statements are true or false, but I don't need to do that, actually. But because I know, what I learned from the leader of the church then, he never called himself such. But he said, Sabbath keepers believe they're the only saved persons and all others are sinners. That's what the church taught. He said there were a lot of rules and the fear of God was instilled in us. He said the plain truth was a propaganda pamphlet used to recruit members. He said his parents were excited when they learned the truth. They became members of the church and they got married hastily, like myself and my other half. But he said his assessment is that that was a huge mistake to have gotten married so quickly in the church. He said when the leader died, one parent stayed with the new leader and the other parent left to join the Pentecostal movement. He said we were confused. We felt betrayed when all that happened and eventually parents separated. He said the feasts were fun, but they were mandatory and they were very expensive. Imagine this, 20% of our income is gone, so we are forced to live on hand-me-downs. That is the legacy left on him by the Church of the Worldwide Church of God, part of the legacy. He said they were not allowed to use makeup. They were not allowed to watch certain Christmas movies. They felt alienated from the rest of society. They were forced to eat food which were different from what others enjoyed. So the unleavened bread was not so welcoming after all. And he says there was constant talk of apocalypse. Church, frequent discussion talking about apocalypse. And then he said no one told us that we were part of a cult and that hurt. And then he says, smash the like button, share and subscribe. I say, absolutely no. Absolutely no. I grieve for him in my heart, but I want us to look at the bigger problem that this young man experienced and his family. But to sum up, what he said is that we stop eating unleavened bread. We no longer eat the bread of affliction. We no longer wanted to hear the hard sayings. So I felt the need to analyze what was going on in my own mind. What was the problem, the real problem? Is affliction something that we should always seek to avoid? Are hard sayings something we should always want to avoid? So I sat down and I said, I examined it carefully and says, I need to get to the bottom of this. And so I began to look at hard. H-A-R-D. Just a four-letter word. What's in this word or this experience called hard? What's in it? The first thing I noticed is that it could be something real or it could be a perception. So our first task is to determine, is this thing a perception which means that it might not necessarily be what you say it is. Or is it real? And if it is real, what do I do with it? Very subjective situation. So, as he did, many others were bitten by this subjectivity bug. If it's hard, let's avoid it. If it's hard, we decide that it's hard. So I went to examine, again, as I said, the concept of hard. And I discovered again that there was a common approach to hard, a view that if it is easy, it's good, it's nice. If it is easy, it's good and it's nice. If it is hard, it is to be avoided. I said, but there must be something wrong with that perception. So the view abroad is that a successful, meaningful life is defined by what is easy and not what is hard. And I said, but that's a wrong approach. A successful, meaningful life should be defined by what is true. So whether something is hard or easy, the bottom line is that, is it true? If it is true, we have to embrace it. If it is not true, easy or hard, let it go. So truth is what we use to determine how we live. So if the way of God, the Almighty, expressed in this bread of affliction, if that way is true, as hard as it is, I have no choice but to eat. I have to eat, if it's true. So I continued to dig into hard, and because I'm also affected by what is hard. I don't like things that are hard. And I'm sure all of us are in the same situation. But we do know that there are times when we just have to work with things that are hard. We know that. So I found that hard is deceptive. Hard is confusing. What I need to know is what is true. Let's give some examples of what hard does to us, does to persons. Let's go to Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2. See what we make of hard when the hard times come. Chapter 2, verse 23. Exodus 2, verse 23. Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So life was hard in Egypt. They cried out to God. It was painful. We know the story. They were delivered, set on their way out of Egypt to the promised land. They had to pass through what is called a wilderness. And here's what happened to them as they encountered some other hard stuff. Numbers 14. But bear in mind what they felt back in Egypt. Now go to Numbers 14 and let's see what is happening here as they grapple with hard. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night, and all the children of Israel complained. They were so sad and weeping because they felt it was impossible to go in and take over the land. To get in the land, they saw the grapes, they saw the fruit, how fruitful it was, but they were afraid of the people who lived there, and so this is what happened. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness." No, but wait a minute. they got a chance to stay in Egypt if they wanted to. If they really, really wanted to die in Egypt, they could have. But they didn't want that. Verse 3, why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. Now, I don't know if you find this as fascinating as I do. Egypt is hard, we have to leave. The wilderness is hard, but we can't stay here. Let's go back to Egypt. So, isn't Egypt hard as well? So which hard is more livable? Where you're free, you're not slaves to anyone, but you encounter some challenges, or you're slaves in Egypt, but you have all the leeks and the garlics and the onions and so forth. Which hard is better? How did they choose, come to make their choices? It's fascinating. So we notice what happened with these people, what hard did to them. One, it created fear, it created doubt. We are going to die in this place. It robbed them of hope. The hope is that we will one day walk into the promised land. It drained whatever little faith they had. So they had no faith in persons who were guiding them and leading them into the promised land. Hard robbed them of hope. It robbed them of their faith. And they believed deep in their hearts that we're all going to die in this place. And it went further. Because hard now caused them to wrongfully blame God, blame Moses. It's not difficult. When we find ourselves facing challenges, to find somewhere to put the blame. Unfortunately, who got the blame? God, who brought them here, and Moses, who had to deal with his own fears to bring them to this point. In fact, they wanted to stone Moses at one point, kill him, appoint a leader and go back to Egypt. Why did you bring us out here, Moses, to kill us off? You should have left us in Egypt. I mean, to say this is ingratitude in the least, I mean, it's not saying enough. But it borders on fear, doubt, no hope, no faith. It also robbed them of the ability to see other options. So, okay, we can't go back to Egypt. We can't stay in this wilderness. Is there another option? But then hard somehow blinded them to that. It's either here in the wilderness or back in Egypt, back in hell. So hard, H-A-R-D, lied to them. Of course, hard was just, is in their own minds. I discovered as well that hard is a necessary test, which we don't like. Again, hard is a test, and it's necessary. Deuteronomy chapter 8. H-A-R-D, hard. Deuteronomy chapter 8, let's look at verse 15. 14, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God, that's verse 14, who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness, in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land, where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, and who fed you in the wilderness with manna. So it was not a nice place to be, the wilderness. We accept that. And this is where they were. And verse 2, Deuteronomy 8, and you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you, to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you and allowed you to hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. So he led them through a terrible wilderness. They never had the abundance of water and food that they had in Egypt. But God did all of that to test them. So they were literally feeding on the bread of affliction as they came out of Egypt. Life was hard. But guess what? It wasn't impossible. So when they encountered the difficulties, they said, you know, let's go back to hardness. So we learn that hard is a necessary test. God was testing them. See what is in their hearts. And he knew what is in their hearts, but they need to know what was in their own hearts. So he wanted them to see what was in their hearts. Now here's what hardness also did to them. Hard made them blind. Look at verse 4, Deuteronomy 8. Hard made them blind. And this perhaps was the worst thing that could have happened to them. Verse 4 says, your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know, well, that's verse 4 is enough. Your garments did not wear out, your foot did not swell, and of other places your sandals were quite sound. Brand new after all these years of walking. Brand new. So what did they not see? They did not see the shoes. They did not see the clothes. They did not see that their feet were fine. They did not remember that they got water from the rock, that they got food from the sky. They didn't remember the plagues, the parting of the Red Sea. And they certainly never had their thoughts set on the fact that, or could see that there is a great power with us. The hard blinded them to the presence, the awareness of this great power with us. And I tell you, I have experienced hard in many ways. Time won't allow to go into all of the times. As I was sharing earlier, walking 2 miles to school as a youngster, among other things, it was hard. And all of us, I suspect, have endured some hard stuff. But what have we learned from hard or the bread of affliction? Hard, they say, separates the men from the boys. Tell us something more about hard. Let's look at Matthew 19. Verse 21. Jesus said to him, the rich young ruler, if you want to be perfect, which he wanted, go sell what you have, give it to the poor, and you will have treasures in heaven, and come follow me. But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. I can't do that. That's hard. I cannot sell my goods and give it to the poor and come follow you, Lord, in as much as I want perfection, because that is hard. Okay. Let's go to Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2, verse 45. Verse 44, 45. Now all who believed were together, and they had all things in common, and sold their possessions and goods, and divided them among all as anyone had need. So the rich young ruler couldn't do this, but the brethren in Acts could do it. So it wasn't impossible. It wasn't impossible. So hard really separates the men from the boys. It was hard for the king to resist Mrs. Bathsheba. But it wasn't hard for Joseph to walk away from Mrs. Potiphar. So hard is subjective. It's determined by how persons conceive or perceive hard. And these are lessons that we have to learn. I mean, there are times when I find something that I'm required to do very hard, and I look around and I see others doing it. What can I say to myself? It is doable. Am I up to it? I am not sure I would want to take another Cessna to Guyana. That much I can say. That one was hard. But I guess if I have to. But yes, it's subjective. It is also selective. You know, I can do one thing that is hard and another thing that I consider hard and don't do it. So, I find hard a very interesting fellow. Want to know our true potential? Have to face some hard. Let's look at Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5. So I find when I look at these concepts, these one simple word, how we are affected by these things, it is fascinating. The lessons that I should learn, if I don't examine these things clearly, I'm not going to learn. I miss them. Certainly miss them. So Romans chapter 5 and verse 3, it says, "And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations." No, I am learning to accept tribulations or afflictions. I don't reach the part of glorying in it yet, but I'm hoping to get there. "Not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance." Well, that's the same thing as hard. Hard produces perseverance. And affliction is the same thing as tribulation. It's supposed to produce perseverance. There's something, a benefit we can get out of it, if we're willing to do what is necessary to get that benefit. But it does rob us of our true potential. If we quit when the going gets rough, we will never know what we could achieve. We can't. Because if the rough going is taking us someplace, but we quit before, how are we going to know what we could accomplish? If we're going on a hike up a hill, and we stop in the middle and turn back, middle of the road, how can we determine whether we would have reached the summit, the pinnacle? We won't. We never tried it. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. "And so, to the extent that the young man had that experience in the worldwide Church of God, and possibly, let's say from a point of perception, he perceived that all of what he said was true. All that he saw was real. Does that mean that there is going to be any group, any organization, anywhere in the world where we're going to find things easy? Was there any truth being preached in the worldwide Church of God? Can't know. He never stayed. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." we won't be tempted beyond what we are able. Do we all know what we are able to bear? No, we don't know. Until we are in the situation, then we'll be able to determine how much of it we can bear. But we all feel, you know, when the going gets rough, that I can't bear any more of this. Well, how do you know? How do we know whether or not we could bear more and produce more perseverance? We don't know. Jesus said at one point, or is it one of the writers, we have not yet resisted unto blood. What are the things we resist? Not unto blood. We haven't reached there yet. Jesus did. So here's what Christ has to say to us as we struggle with hard. You know, he wants us to get a realistic view of hard versus easy. The church versus the world. So here's what he said to us. In Matthew chapter 11. Matthew 11. Because that matzo can be hard. Matthew 11 verse 28. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Well, one would have to acknowledge that one is heavy laden. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So what was Jesus saying? Every other yoke, every other burden is heavier than mine. Therefore, how do we choose? Shouldn't we choose the lighter yoke and the lighter burden? Of course. Story was told, I don't know where I got it once, but some persons were carrying yokes and burdens, and they felt that, you know, that they had gone too far. They need to get rid of the yokes and the burdens. So they went to someone, I think it was a king of the land, and they said, look, I want to exchange my yoke and my burden, because other person's yoke and burden must be lighter than mine. He says, okay, put down your yoke and your burden and take up the one that you think is lighter and easier. But guess what happened? He looked around. He looked at the different yokes and the burdens. He took up back his own, put it on his shoulder, and he went away. Yeah, he went back with his own. Jesus says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. But do we all believe that? Does the world believe that? I don't think so. Have we ever tested Jesus on that matter to see if he's right? That really and truly, let me see if you're telling us the truth, that your burden is really lighter. Well, we'll have to walk with him. And as he said, we must take up our cross, our stake, and follow him. Follow him. All the way to Calvary. So if it's not the yoke of Christ, it's going to be some other yoke, some other bread. It's either the church that is following Christ or the world. So, when you look at the matzo, you know, when I just started to keep the days, I lived with share apartment with my brother. He was an unbeliever. And come Passover time / Easter, he would bring in his nice, big, juicy, very colorful, full of sugar, full of yeast, Easter bun. And would put it on the dining table right beside my matzo box. So, I don't know if he, his intention was that I would forget which one is the matzah and which is the bun. But he felt that what I was doing was just stupid. But his bun, though tempting, was not a temptation to get us to eat it after all. I mean, we're too excited about the truth. But the point is, if we're going to use that situation, which of the bread, his bun or the matzah, would have been healthier for us? Just on a health basis. He's in the world with his bun, and I am in the church of God with my matzah. And I am certain my matzah is healthier. No matter how attractive the bun is, my matzah was healthier. That much I could tell him. So, again, the world, maybe the first bit of deception that the world tells us is that out here you are free. Out here in the world you are free. Do anything you want to do. And that's so much of a lie. One, because there is something called government that has their own restrictions. So you see the restrictions God placed on us, you say, oh, those are too onerous. We out there, we are free. Yes, the government has some restrictions. Well, we can break them whenever we want to. And we get away and we are free. So I learned that the restrictions God placed on us was first and foremost to prevent us from destroying ourselves. The food laws, the boredom sometimes, the long sermons, and I'll try not to be long. The isolation from the world, the many splits, the expensive feasts, hard, but I would rather those than what the world has to offer. I would rather those. So the lie, the first lie that the world tells us is that we are free to do as we please, and that's not true. So if you have the time, just Google the population in any prison. Just Google that. How many persons are in prison? They did not get up at age 3, 4, 5 and says, Mom, Dad, I want to go to prison when I'm 20. But that's where they are. How did they get there? Because they're free. Free to do as you please. And you could look at the situation in the world from that perspective and just see what are we getting from being free versus having the restrictions of Almighty God in our lives. The fatal accidents, and they're happening in my country like it's crazy. Because people are free. I mean, fatal accidents, the ones that leave vehicles crushed. 3 vehicles collide and awful. You know where they happen? On the highways. On the beautiful, lovely highways. The broad road. And what is the main reason for that? They feel free to do as they please. They know that. Listen, they know the rules of the road, the speed limit, everything. They are free. Press the gas. They are free. And you see the news report, mangled pieces of metal. People have to be cut from the metal. The matter of stress. I could ask if, you know, any of us have felt that thing called stress. Stress to get a good education, getting the loan, the student loan, paying for the food, the transportation, everything. I remember one lady called a talk show host one day. She says, my daughter is in her second year at university, pursuing her doctorate. And I don't have any money to pay for her so she can sit her exams. And she's mad. She's crying. And it's so awful. She feels hopeless. After 2 years of hard work, this is where it's at. So the lady was on the air begging for financial support. The stress to get the education, the stress to get a good job, the stress to keep the good job, a good high-paying job, the stress to deal with some co-workers, the stress to make life, the pandemics, and they tell us that there are more coming. Disease X. The stress in deciding what is the best food items to eat. Diabetics and people with high blood pressure. And every day you turn on the TV, they tell you that this thing is not good for you, that is not good for you. That. So what should we eat? Sometimes I wonder. One person tell me, oh, rice is not good for you. I say, oh, okay, I come off the rice. Another one says, rice is good for you. I said, which one I want to talk in the truth? So don't tell me that the world, with all of its aches and pains and problems, is a lighter yoke. It's not. So looking at the future, what do we see up ahead? Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 21. What is coming in the world? For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor ever shall be. Great tribulation. That's up the road coming. I picked up this magazine on the way here on the Caribbean Airlines. It's called Caribbean Beat. I saw this article written by a man by the name of Suniti Maharaj. So he's the managing director of the Lloyd Best Institute of the West Indies. Here's what he said. Those are a few paragraphs. Bubbling between the tectonic plates of the past and the future is the molten present, like lava, the molten present, a seething mass of problem and possibility guided by the precision compass of unintended consequences. I mean, there's a way with words. Unintended consequences. We never intend for these things. With an insouciance or lack of concern grounded in technological confidence, we have been hurtling towards the future with the expectation of more and better, oblivious to the gathering storm of the Anthropocene age with human-induced disasters like climate change and pandemics in a world order unequipped to deliver peace, equity, and justice for all. This was not what we imagined when we breezed into the 21st century. Seduced by our progress, we expected a braver new world with its alluring promise of millennium development goals fulfilled. Caught now between past and future, the present finds no easy passage. And he quoted one of your guys' popular soca songs, Pay the Devil, Jab Jab. I don't even know that one. I looked it up. Yeah, one of those. What does the future want of us? There's no mystery here. We know the past too well. The future demands unity of purpose and collective action. As we approach 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming, Earth's safety threshold is on the verge of being breached. The consequences of runaway warming would be the destruction of most of the planet by the end of the century. Would we call this gentleman a doomsday prophet? Well, say Mr. Armstrong was a doomsday prophet. What about this gentleman? But there's cause for concern, and whether or not climate change is true, it's not whether it's true, it's the perception that it is happening, and then with the perception comes the way to fix it. And the way to fix it is going to be pretty interesting. We start to see some of that already. So we hear that everything is going digital. They're digitalizing everything, including our teeth. Will all be digitalized. They tell us that we will soon stop eating beef and goat and chicken. We will be eating lab-grown food. Something they just generate in a lab, take a little DNA from some animal, call it chicken, mix it up in some something, and out comes meat. That's what they're planning for us. And of course, the other thing called gender confusion is right here. Gender confusion. And the subtle ways that these people are trying to get at our children. They say they're coming for our children. We have to be so careful. And they're using every subtle means to do it. The things the kids love to watch. Even this popular Disney people have gone into it. Gender confusion. So which bread is harder? Which bread is safer? The unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, or the bread that the world is offering? Fat, attractive, sugar-laden, yeast-laden Easter bun? Is that more healthy, beneficial? Which way of life is more likely to kill us? The wilderness experience, where the Almighty, by His power, produced water from rock and food from the sky? Or is it better to go back to Egypt, see if there's any leeks and garlics and so forth left back after the destruction? And then looking forward, there's another force, another being that's going to force its mark on us. And we know who that person was, is. Call him the beast. The beast is just waiting to force his mark on people. And I say, towards what end? What is his goal? What's his purpose? Where is he going? So I say to us on this first day of Unleavened Bread, 2024, the journey is long. The dangers are many. The road is narrow and it's hard. But where is it leading? It's leading us to true freedom. It's leading to wisdom. It's leading us to a good, healthy, peaceful place. It is true. It is absolute true, this bread that we're feasting on during this days of unleavened bread. It is consistent. It's not going to change. They can't manufacture this one in a lab and call it lab-grown unleavened bread. If they try to do that, we make our own. If we be allowed to get the ingredients. But that's another thing. We might can't get the ingredients. It is absolutely true. It is revelatory in that this bread, Christ, we know, is revealing to us all that we need to know to survive in this time, in this wilderness. It is objective. It's not subjective. It is very objective. You can look at it, see the evidence of its goodness, of its purity, of its the health benefits, everything is there. It is pointing us to, it is inspiring us to, and it is motivating us to find our true potential. It's not a Christian thing that hardships produce, as they say, the best out of persons. It's not just a Christian thing. It's a belief that is held in the world at large, that hardships can make you into a person you never dreamed you could be. So we're not fooled by hardship, by what is hard. So it is revealing our true potential in this life and ultimately in the life to come, which is immortality. So I want to close in Psalm 81. Psalm 81. Reading from verse 1. Sing aloud to God, O strength. Make a joyful shout to the God of Jacob. Raise a song and strike the timbrel, the pleasant harp with the lute. Blow the trumpet at the time of the new moon, at the full moon, on my solemn feast day. For this is a statute for Israel, a law of the God of Jacob. This he established in Joseph as a testimony when he went throughout the land of Egypt, where I heard a language I did not understand. I removed his shoulder from the burden. His hands were freed from the baskets. You called in trouble, and I delivered you. I answered you in the secret place of thunder. I tested you at the waters of Meribah. Hear, O my people, and I will admonish you. O Israel, if you will listen to me, there shall be no foreign gods among you, nor shall you worship any foreign god. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. So here's the conclusion of the matter. Open your mouth wide, and I will fill it. I will fill it with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. I will fill it with the flesh of Jesus Christ, your Passover Lamb, your High Priest, your coming King, Lord and Savior. I will fill it with truth, with wisdom, with encouragement, with mercy, with grace, with justice. I will fill it. Do one more thing. Take a look at my laws, my commandments, my judgments. Compare them with what the world is offering. And tell me which of these is best for you. These 7 days of unleavened bread, as we heard earlier, we must be on our guard. Don't let the guards down. Don't get tricked. Avoid certain places, because sometimes, I could tell you stories. We're not so sure what can happen just by being at a particular location. So if we can, avoid certain places. And for the 7 days, let's just open our mouths wide and have the Lord fill them with good things. All right. We pause at that point and pray that the Lord will fill us with the best that he has to offer.